Welcome to Education Perspectives. I am your host, Liza Holland. This is a podcast that explores the role of education in our society from a variety of lenses. Education needs to evolve to meet the needs of today and the future. Solving such huge issues requires understanding. Join me as we begin to explore the many perspectives of education. I am so pleased to welcome Justin Bathin to Education Perspectives. Justin is chair and associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership Studies at the University of Kentucky. He's also a co-director of the Center for Next Generation Leadership and the director of the Next Generation Scholars Dual Credit Program for the University of Kentucky. Justin works directly with schools and school leaders to reform the systems that support the learner experience in school. Hello, Justin. Thanks so much for being the first podcast guest for Education Perspectives.
Yay, I'm excited to be first. It is an honor.
Well, you were quite an inspiration for all of it in the first place. And so I really do appreciate you taking the time because you have so many different perspectives on education. I thought you would be the ideal first guest.
I'm happy to be the first guest.
From my perspective, you and I really got to know one another in the beginning portions of the STEAM Academy here in Lexington, Kentucky. And it was such an exciting thing from a parent's perspective because we were really made a part of the process and the innovation was just so very different than what we'd seen and heard in school so far, that was really what spurred me into being interested in this innovation portion of education in the first place. So I think sometimes we all forget to take a look at why we do this in the first place. So taking that 30,000 foot view, in your opinion, why do we educate people?
Wow, what an amazing first question. So I actually love that. I just saw a video that our partners at What School Could Be did where they just went out on the street and asked people, you know, what is school for? And, you know, they got all kinds of amazing answers. I guess for me, I think school has a variety of purposes, but for me, school serves a very, very particular purpose in a democracy. In that it really is the instrument of democracy. So I don't know, when people think about like what makes a democracy work, I'm sure most people think of laws and constitutions and Congress and, you know, all of these things. And I think that's part of it. Of course, part of my background is as a lawyer, so I appreciate that part of the equation. But I think that a democracy actually works in its public schools. The public schools are the one place where the vast majority of society intersect with each other. Not all, of course. There's a part of society that is homeschooling, a part of society that is engaging in private schooling. But 90%+ of the public interact together in schools, public schools. And so for me, the sort of core driver is as a sort of foundational element of keeping a democracy alive and thriving. All of the component parts of that, the economic part of that, the citizenship part of that. So there's a lot of component parts, but this sort of front line of democracy, the actual doing of democracy, I think happens most in schools.
Great answer. I too have been tuning into that, what is school for, and very interesting answers. So any of our listeners can check that out at What School Could Be.
Yeah, if people really, really care about this, there's people that have written entire books about that exact question. I think of Neil Postman's End of Education, where he, in that book, this is a philosopher who was alive throughout the middle of the last century. He really challenges us to think beyond the sort of everyday economic sort of point of school that everyone sees, right? When people think, what's the point of school? They think like, well, we need workers for, you know, the jobs that are out there today. And we need people that can understand and build new technologies to create more jobs. And okay, great. But there are bigger purposes. And so he talks about spaceship Earth and like our responsibility to the planet and those kinds of things. So if you want a book that really goes far on that question, go check out The End of Education by Neil Postman.
I'm a little bit of an education wonk myself, so I might have to do that. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that your background is that you were a lawyer. Tell me about your journey to getting involved in education.
Yeah, so I love schools and I love teaching. And for many of us educators, it takes a while to sort of know that. I felt a calling to be a teacher early in life. And so in my undergraduate program, that's what I wanted to do. We can unpack colleges of education at some other day, but the college of education that I was part of at was going to ask me to stay in school longer to finish the education component. I was catching up with my wife. This was the very beginning of dual credit. Now I help run the dual credit program here at the University of Kentucky. It's very, very circular, but my wife was way ahead of me in school. So I was doing my best to keep up and catch up. And here is the School of Education saying, you need 5 years to get a bachelor's. And I was just like, oh, I was on track to graduate in three. So that those two things didn't go well together. And I got a job teaching under a federal program in my hometown, only 3 years after I had graduated from that high school. And so that was really weird, and I would not recommend it to others. But I did see in my time there the role that the superintendent was playing, the principal, and I was very curious about the leadership component of it. As I asked them, like, how do I become a principal or superintendent? They're like, well, you know, get that education degree, so that's 2 more years, and then you need to be a teacher for 3 or 4 years, and then after that, go get another 2-year degree. So like in 10 years, you can go be a principal. And I was like, okay, who else makes an impact around here? And I saw the school board attorney having a lot of impact on decision making. And so my wife was studying for the LSAT, and it wasn't, you know, we flipped and I wound up taking the LSAT instead. And yeah, so I went to law school. But I knew immediately in law school that I didn't want to be a traditional lawyer. I found out in law school that you could be a professor of education law. It required another doctorate. And so that was like, wow, that's exactly the kind of itch that I feel like I need to scratch. And so that's the direction that I went. It was expensive and it took a bunch of years in school, but finally wound up here at UK and it's been the dream.
I think it's important for people to know that there are different pathways to be able to achieve what you really want and to be able to have an impact. That's awesome. So tell me, obviously you said it was a dream. Tell me about some of your fondest memories of being involved in education.
Well, STEAM Academy is absolutely up there at the top. I'm super proud of that school and what it has become in this city here in Lexington. That was a super fond memory. When I first got to UK, we transitioned a Department of Educational Leadership Studies that prepares principals, superintendents, doctoral programs to be an online global player, one of the very first in the world. And that was very difficult. It was one of my very, very first major educational innovations where I was actually taking on a leadership role. And so I made a ton of mistakes in that journey, but I look back on it super fondly with a lot of pride. Then, of course, the center that we built from scratch is a tremendous point of pride. Building a center is a very different kind of task. And so that's been fun. So I love my job because I get to play on a very daily basis, create new things in the world. And for me, that is the thing that really gets me up in the morning, is imagining a different future and then actually helping.
You know, one of the things that I noticed in my education journey is how incredibly siloed it is. What people know in early childhood is not the same as what's in elementary school and all the way up to higher education. And so for those of us who are in that silo here and there, tell us a little bit about what the center actually does. And is there an application for those folks out in the field?
Yeah. So the Center for Next Generation Leadership has developed over the course of, I think we're 12 or 13 years old now, as long as you get results. We have had a great impact, but at some point along the way, especially in doing STEAM Academy, the high school, you know, high schools are this interesting intersection that everything in the K-12 system for a long time has been geared to get kids ready for college. And there's certainly the thought of career and college, but for quite some time, we were asking dual credit questions from the beginning, and we learned a lot about dual credit along the way. And so across that journey, I think we began to really see the space that transitions between high school and college as very impactful on both systems. And so our center has now invested in this world of dual credit, and we lead the actual implementation of dual credit at the University of Kentucky, bringing a statewide model that's more equitable, that uses a different sort of educator platform to think about how to do these kinds of jobs in the modern digital world, where students don't necessarily need to be in the same exact physical room as their instructor in order to get a great learning experience, but then also not going completely to the other side of that, which is no instructor at all, just an online course shell and asynchronous. And like, you know, so what is a great middle ground that we could fall in love with and then sustain over time that allows best parts of dual credit to reach all kinds of kids across the state? So we've invested in the higher ed space in there. So our center really, I would say at this point, is a K through 14 kind of center in terms of the actual application of what we do. I think we're interested in early childhood questions. We are interested in 15 through 20, whatever those are, kinds of questions. Of course, I currently department chair of a graduate department here, so I care about graduate school, but primarily the center focuses on that K through 14 space right now.
Excellent. It's such an incredibly big boat to turn, you know, massive bureaucracy. And, you know, when that big ship got stuck in the canal during the pandemic, I thought, you know, that's a perfect analogy for our education system. There's just so much there. How can we innovatively figure out how to get it unstuck and to be able to make it work? Obviously, I'd like to talk a little bit more about STEAM. And again, that's because I was involved in it. One of the things that I really appreciated was that it was very focused on practical applications and actually having kids solve problems and engage in critical thinking and watching the kids light up that way because they're offered different ways of learning was just really pretty magical for me. And so as I look towards the future, I'm hoping that we are able to integrate that into more and more of our programming. But I also know that that's really hard to measure. And you kind of get whatever you are measuring for in this type of a system. So can you talk to us about ways that you might be able to measure that skill set that is so incredibly important in this day and age?
Yeah, so absolutely. It's both a great question, and in many ways, it is the critical question of our time. Because in Kentucky right now, in this year, 2022, because Kentucky over the last 10 years is ahead of most other states in the United States. We're not ahead of the rest of the world necessarily, but many states have not been doing the work that Kentucky's been doing the last 10 years to try to figure out how to do more of what you saw at STEAM as part of the everyday experience of school all across the state. And that's not to say that it's happening in every single classroom across Kentucky. It is not. But there are at least a dozen, maybe 20, 25 school districts that are curious about those questions. There are 50 plus 70 maybe schools across the state that you could point to and say, like, they are trying to figure that out. And so, but as part of that, right, like we all know the last 25 years, the last generation of education in America was all about test scores. I don't know what people make of test scores, but I think test scores give you a number. Right. And most importantly, they give you a percentile rank. Like, my kid is in the fifth percentile of all third graders. And the average person in the public can understand my kid is in the fifth percentile, or my kid is in, more likely, they're in the 85th percentile. And look how amazing and proud I am of them. They're in the 85th percentile of one specific thing in terms of reading, perhaps, or maybe reading comprehension. It could be some kind of mathematical assessment. It's probably not even a science or social studies assessment. You know, we really only were testing some things that are easily tested by computers in reading and math. It's a data point. It's a valid data point. I don't want to dismiss those scores. Some others will just completely dismiss them. It is a data point. There are many, many other data points that are valuable. So when it comes to the kind of experiences that you saw at Steam and how do you measure those things? Well, we find the most powerful measurement is just show us what you did. And so I think most things in life function that way. So when it comes to a business meeting, for instance, and a small team gets put in charge of a project at a small business, you know, the questions are very much about like, so what happened? How did it go? Like, what kind of revenue are you seeing as a result of this? Show us. And a lot of education is not actually built to show what kids know. And so the most powerful measures come from when kids are asked to defend their learning, when kids are asked to do performance assessments. So the difference, think about the driving test, right? In society, we ask kids to do two things when it comes to getting a driver's license. You need to pass a standardized test where, you know, we're going to ask you some multiple choice questions about stop signs and whatever. You know, the more important point is like get in a car and drive down the road and show us that you know how to do this. So that's a performance assessment. We don't have nearly enough performance assessment in our schools in the core courses, because there is a lot of performance assessment in the music program, in the arts program, in the CTE engineering program, the welding program. There's performance assessment in band. There's performance assessment in athletics. However, when it comes to math and English and social studies, and science, there's little performance assessment. Why? Those are the ones we tested. So all the subjects that we decided to standardize test have really lost the performance assessment roots. So a lot of what we're encouraging schools to do is just go back to what those subjects look like before we decided to just standardize test en masse all kids. And so the measures then, I think, are a little bit more authentic to the kid. It does rely on the professional judgment of teachers more. Grades matter in that equation more than ACT. So for instance, here at the University of Kentucky, we went test optional. I don't see a day when we'll ever go back to being test required. It's test optional. And so you can submit the standardized test or you can choose not to. What we actually care more about now is grades. We care more about like, what courses did you take? Did you challenge yourself? What does all your extracurriculars look like? We care more about the broader story that's going on with that kid rather than just the single number. And the data in the higher ed world, and I think this would be true in K-12 as well, says that you make better decisions when you rely on more of that holistic data than just a single mathematical data point.
Honestly, that's the same thing in how companies evaluate themselves. If we are looking to educate and produce productive citizens, we need to be able to give them the skills to be able to function in the real world. And I think that's great. Now we just need to work on that little thing about how many years of experience you're going to have to get a particular degree that you ran into. Mm-hmm. But luckily, we're finding some ways around it. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the good stuff. It's exciting and it's so great that we have particularly pockets of innovation, a lot of them led by you. Tell me about the challenges. Tell me about what's frustrating to you, what is holding you back from continuing to implement these good things.
Well, there's, I guess, two layers to that question. The thing that frustrates me the most is structural barriers to opportunity. And those are a lot of parts of the system that we built. We all have to take ownership of this thing that we have, right? The system is getting the results it's designed to get. Like you got to start with that mental place, right? This is not like when people complain about test scores or they feel like the education system's not good enough. This is what it's designed to do. So if you're not happy with the results, then you really have to question the structures. A lot of those structures were built with segregation and oppression in mind. We didn't build an education system in the beginning that was meant to give all kids an equal opportunity. And so a lot of what frustrates me constantly is the remaining structural barriers. And you can, that work in education, all know that you could go to a classroom full of seventh graders and see what their assessments look like. And in that space, you can largely predict where those journeys are going to go because the system has largely made its choices by that age. You know, that to me is absolutely absurd and crazy. In my own kids and in my own life, people change a lot during these years. The seventh grader that you think you have may not at all be the junior in high school, or particularly might not be the 24-year-old who actually falls in love with an area and gets passionate about it and go builds a world-changing company and sends rockets to the moon and whatever, right? Like, we all know these many stories of people who went and did life-changing things, even though the school system would have assumed that they weren't going to. So we see that all the time, and that is super frustrating to me. What holds us back from moving those barriers is a lot of very adult things. And it drives me nuts when we let our adult problems get in the way of what we can all agree would be a better way for kids. And so I'll give you examples. The thing that is the absolute biggest limitation that I've experienced in the decade plus of doing innovation work with schools is the schedule. So, you know, how time is allocated is a very adult problem, right? Like, when kids show up to school in the morning, I don't know how much they care about what their day is going to look like. In fact, they would love to have more time to hang out with their friends. Like, if you give kids some more choice in that, you would get a better day. But we, of course, adult, feel like we have to schedule every minute of it. We've got to supervise them for every single minute of the day. They need to be in their boxes and think about what's going on. We literally put them in boxes and we keep them in boxes. And then you have 4 minutes to move from this box to that box. Those are all adult structures that don't have to be there. There's no law requiring those boxes to exist. There's no law requiring you to teach science separately from English. You could teach them together. We choose to impose all of these barriers, these structures, because it's easier for us as adults, right? Like, somebody can set a master schedule, then we can put the master schedule into a computer system. And this is literally how most high schools do their scheduling. The kids are then, the computer just assigns kids to classes. Then the high school schedule is given to the kids. So that's, I think, where all the frustration lies. I want to balance that frustration about the empathy that I have for educators who are doing very difficult jobs. They're serving as the front line of democracy, right? Like, so the task here is enormous with young people who don't always want to be there, and young people don't always, you know, behave in the ways you expect. So they're dealing with so much on every single day that to then ask them to restructure the system in real time is a tremendously difficult ask, and one that is completely unfair to ask them to do. But here we are. I mean, you know, this is the place that we live in America, which is we don't really fund education enough to tackle the really hard parts. And yet everyone in society is a little bit frustrated with schools because we don't tackle the hard parts. It's a difficult place to be. But, you know, for me personally, at a personal level, I love the difficult challenges. And so I am 100% comfortable living simultaneously in, we have to do this, and we have almost no resources to do this.
Talk about a massive challenge. And it just seems to me, I do a lot of work in the leadership space, and I cannot see another institution that is so micromanaged as education. And it's very difficult, you know, if you're tracking every single moment, for a teacher to feel empowered to do something different and to try to make it work. I was very touched by watching a TED Talk by Sir Ken Robinson, who talked about how when he saw kids at the very beginning of their journey, your kindergartners, your first graders, et cetera, and they were so curious and so full of questions and thinking about ideas out of the box. And he said, and then I get to visit a high school and we've beaten it out of them. And I thought, you know, all those boxes, all those strictures, all that kind of stuff, it's really not helping us to build kids with the skills and the confidence that they need to be out in our information economy. I resonate with that a lot, because you're right. It's not really the educators. They're stuck in a system.
For the listeners, go Google or go to YouTube and search for Ken Robinson, and you'll find his number one TED Talk, which is a great entry point. There's many other great talks from Ken, Ken passed away during the pandemic, unfortunately. Sir Ken Robinson, actually, he's a British knight, or I don't know how that works over there.
Honored by the Queen.
Yeah, whatever that is. So, but it is a great starter place for everyone, whether or not you're an educator or a community member, a parent, it's a great place to start.
Well, and that brings me to one of my final questions for all of the folks that come on Education Perspectives. Sometimes we don't realize who the decision makers are, but there are decision makers at all levels, including you as voters. Speaking of democracy, if you pull out further, you are electing public officials that then turn around and create laws, which are then turned into regulations, which then basically make up the structure of what we're doing in education. And in defense of legislators, they are expected to know a little bit about absolutely everything. But, you know, how can they really know what might be best for education? So I would love to have you answer the question. And this could also go to, you know, the leadership like at KDE and that sort of a thing. What would you like those decision makers to know?
Yeah, that's a great question. From a legislator standpoint, I don't think they understand how talented educators are. One of the crazy things for me is in many of Kentucky's counties, the schools are the biggest employer. I mean, so they are the largest business in many of these legislators' jurisdictions. So, like, these people simultaneously have the ability to educate our youth and to run our largest companies in many of our small towns. That's a lot to handle. And then go compare the salaries of these people who are handling multiple complex things versus the local business owner who's running a bank or something like that, which I'm sure it's very complex. Nothing against bankers. They're an important part of society. But educators are doing equally complex, if not more complex work, and getting paid a fraction of that. They're there because they love. There's love. They wouldn't be there if it wasn't for love, because any one of us that are in the education field, including myself as a lawyer, can stop this and go get paid more to do a different thing. But we don't, because we love our communities. We love our state. We love the kids. We believe in a future that is brighter and better. And we want to spend our time investing in the people, the kids, who are going to control that future. And so there's an amazing depth of talent and love and passion there that in all of the broad conversations about how much of a pension do they deserve, or, you know, should we certify teachers this way or that way, or, you know, it all gets very lost. And I think if you spend time with teachers in intimate ways, you really begin to pick up on the depth of goodness that is there. And then for many of us, including myself in a role here at the university, a lot of my job is just to try to be of service, because they're the ones that are doing the hard work on the front lines, dealing with children coming from broken families. And, like, we all see these challenges in society, and all of us feel bad about these challenges in society, but we don't deal with it every day. They do. And so a lot of our job is, what can we do to make your lives better and improve the circumstances of your job so that we can help that kid that needs help, right? So that's the piece I wish that they would spend more time, I guess, in classrooms and less time in banks.
Hear, hear. They need that perspective. Absolutely. Well, Justin, this has been a fantastic discussion. I really do appreciate what you said. And honestly, a lot of the things that you had to put forward were insightful. And I hope that our listeners out there will take advantage of some of the suggestions, and those decision makers out there, please think about that perspective of the educators that absolutely love our kids, because we can do better. Thank you, Justin.
No worries. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Education Perspectives. Feel free to share your thoughts on our Facebook page. Let us know which education perspectives you would like to hear or share. Please subscribe and share with your friends.